All right, welcome to the Volterra podcast number 16. This is an entirely American podcast. I'm here with Ben Schreckinger. How are we doing, Ben?
Top of the morning to you, Governor.
That was a terrible accent. That was a terrible accent.
It's like there's a gap in this podcast without Louis.
Yeah. I'm not sure. It's going to get really heavy. I was talking to my girlfriend before. And I was saying how Louis kind of provides a anchor to keep us somewhat on the ground. I feel like this may get a little esoteric and may get a little wonkish before we're through.
Good.
So a lot of American political stuff has happened over the past couple of days, since last week. At least it seems like the chickens have come home to roost. The hens have come home to roost. What's that saying?
At least the way that Obama's pastor said it was the chickens have come home to roost.
The chickens have come home to roost. And the, reverberations from, the midterms are, being felt. Let's talk about immigration first. Last night, Obama granted a path to citizenship for 5 million-ish undocumented illegal aliens or undocumented aliens. I don't know how you want to put it. Did you see the speech?
I didn't see the speech. Did you?
I did. I watched it earlier today. He just kind of spelled out what he was doing and why he was able to do it through his executive orders or not executive orders, executive actions. Have you heard the reactions from left, right, center?
I saw a lot of like the pre-reactions. I saw like basically, and he's like flip-flop pretty hard here. I saw like Glenn Kessler, the fact checker at the Washington Post, went through pretty extensively, and other people have done this as well. So all of these instances in the past where Obama has basically said, I don't have the authority to do this. Like this is Congress has to do this. I can't do it. This is how a democracy works. So clearly he's gotten someone in the White House counsel's office to write up some memos saying just the opposite. There are limited precedents for what he's done. Reagan and George H.W. Bush have granted like limited amnesties. It looks like on a smaller scale. There's obviously a lot of heated rhetoric. You were saying that Ted Cruz just sort of took some sort of Ciceronian attack on Augustus for ending the Republic and becoming emperor and just subbed in Obama's name and read it on the Senate floor. I don't know. What do you think of the whole thing, Ron?
Yeah, I certainly don't think he's overreaching in an imperial manner manner. It's been called the imperial presidency and all that. I think something needed to be done, whether it be a kickstart or just to kind of allow for his political wing or his political party, the Democrats, to regain some sort of love from the Latin American community or the Hispanic community. So politically, I think it's a smart move. Policy-wise, I don't think it makes a huge amount of difference. I think it's pretty kind of just painting over the cracks, I guess you could say.
Why is that? Because these people just weren't going to get deported anyways?
Basically, yeah, yeah, and it stops it should stop the whole deporter in chief line of critique from from the Hispanic American community. I think it should. When he came to Bridgeport a couple weeks ago, he was interrupted like four times by Dreamers who were protesting and trying to shout their protests at him. And clearly he knew that he was going to do this back then. But yeah.
So you think this is basically, there's going to be this firestorm about it. It's going to blow over and it's just going to be this shrewd political thing where 2016, they're going to have clips of all these Republicans opposing it. And that's just going to turn Hispanic voters against them again.
Yes. Yeah. Do you agree with that? Or do you think it's actually a policy changer?
I honestly don't know much about it. I had been sort of puzzling about why the president was doing this, given how clear of a reversal it was from what he'd been saying in the past. And so your explanation, it makes more sense. It makes more sense to me with what you've said than it did before. So I'm inclined to buy what you're saying.
I think it's first and foremost a political chess move. That's why he waited till after the midterms. The idea that that Hispanics would vote for a Republican candidate anywhere in 2016 is somewhat unlikely, just because of the nativism that is kind of rife in the Republican Party right now. But
it looks like Bush runs with his, Mexican wife and Mexican son.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what this kind of counters, at an early stage, because Jeb Bush is going to need to get through the primaries.
Yeah, that's true. My impression was that after 2012, the Republicans had basically wised up and been like, oh, we need to compromise on immigration because otherwise we're going to lose this massive block for a longer period of time.
Well, that's what they did in the Senate, and then the House fucked them over, fucked the entire Republican Party over by – what's that?
I'm just surprised it's still such like a hot-button issue for like populists on the right that – I thought that moment had sort of come and passed, especially because wasn't net immigration from Mexico negative for the past few years?
It was
really heating up and the American economy has slowed down. So it just seems like all of the pieces were in place for this to stop being such a hot button issue.
Right. It's
surprising to me that it still is.
Well, clearly, I mean, when the, who was it? What was Cantor, the assistant?
He was the majority leader.
He's the majority, not the majority leader. Yeah, he was the House majority leader, loses primarily because his opponent attacks him on compromising on amnesty. What's that?
I didn't realize that's what undid his campaign.
That's the primary talk. That was the primary talking point of Dave Bratt, who will be, I guess he is taking Eric Cantor's seat in the House next year. That was his campaign, was Eric Cantor was going to compromise on immigration reform and allow for amnesty. And that's what brought Laura Ingraham into the race there. And
she endorsed Cantor's opponent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, that's that. Do you have any final thoughts on if the House will bring up a bill? I mean, I'm sure the Republican Congress will propose a bill and probably pass a bill. But do you think it'll be close enough to what Obama wants?
I really don't know. I really don't know much about immigration. My question actually is just given the heat, the vitriol coming from the Republicans on this move about how this is illegal, about how this is this imperial power grab, if they're not going to vote to impeach, Do you think that's in the realm of possibility? Because, I mean, that's consistent with the rhetoric.
Yeah. I mean, the rhetoric has been there the entire presidency. Whether this notch ratchets it up one notch to impeachment level, I mean, who's to say? I think it's 50-50 at this point. There'll be people who will talk of impeaching, but whether Boehner actually has the balls to do it is another story entirely.
I mean, I think if they impeach him over immigration, that's like so long to the Hispanic vote for the Republican Party, right?
Right.
That story is just a dominant one in that community. Right. It must be for the next election cycle if that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so. All right, let's hop off immigration for a second and stay on American politics, because the other potential veto that's come, or has been vetoed already, if I'm not mistaken, is you want to chat a little bit about the Keystone Pipeline, correct?
Yeah, it hasn't been vetoed. It couldn't come to a vote. They didn't get 60 votes for cloture in the Senate.
Right. Okay. So they were voting on whether to vote on it. I misread that. So do you want to give a little rundown? I mean, Keystone Pipeline is again, kind of wonkish. It's kind of a maybe not a niche issue, but something that not a lot of people know a lot about. Do you want to give a quick rundown of what it is?
Sure. So there are these tar sands up in Alberta in Canada, there's oil and gas in them. And it's oil and gas that you couldn't get to before. And now with like fracking, new technology for oil and gas extraction, all of a sudden there's precious natural resources to be had up in these tar sands in Canada, which has been a gold rush in Canada. But they need to get them to market. Right now they've been shipping them on trains and stuff, which isn't that efficient. They want to build a pipeline that goes all the way down through the United States into the Gulf of out to the Gulf of Mexico, so that this stuff can get to American oil refineries and just reach a bigger market. And it's become this lightning rod for the environmental movement, basically because Bill McKibben realized that global warming is this highly abstract concept that just from a psychological level is very difficult to rally people around, but a pipeline that cuts through the center of the United States just has like a lot more symbolic resonance. And so this has become sort of a huge rallying point, and a line in the sand for the environmental movement. And it's been going on through most, if not all, of Obama's presidency. The Republicans and the fossil fuel industry, Chamber of Commerce, have been trying to get the State Department to approve this thing. Because it crosses multiple states, and maybe because it crosses an international boundary, the State Department has authority over whether or not this thing gets approved. And so it's just been this ongoing fight. The Republicans now will continue to try to pass it once their big majorities take office next year. But this came up for a vote now because Mary Landrieu, who's a vulnerable Democrat in the Senate, she has a runoff election coming up, maybe before the end of this month or early November.
It's in January.
It's in January?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, she has a runoff coming up in January. And she wants to – she's a Democrat, but she's from Louisiana, which is a state that's basically owned by the fossil fuel industry. It's been called a petro state. And so she wants to – and this is also probably where the terminus of the pipeline would be. So she wants to say that she got this thing up for a vote in the Senate as like a talking point for her campaign. She was trying to convince all these Democrats to at least allow it to come to a vote to help her in the election, saying that, well, like, if you don't do it now, there's going to be enough Republicans in the Senate to do it in January. So, like, why not just do it now? But it's such a lightning rod issue for the environmental movement. largely for symbolic reasons, although there are like there are also sort of pragmatic reasons to just sort of put a total moratorium on building new fossil fuel infrastructure. So to make a long story short, it was up in the air whether she was going to get the vote. She didn't get the votes. So the Senate didn't vote on it. Even if the Senate had passed it and the House had passed it, the president would have vetoed it. But it is this very interesting ongoing saga, this sort of ongoing environmental saga of the Obama administration that still hasn't been resolved.
And equally kind of symbolic was the agreement in quotation marks and in air quotes that Obama and the Chinese president Xi Jinping came to at the APEC forum this past week as well, or maybe last weekend, that basically China promised to cut to peak their fossil fuel emissions or their carbon emissions by, I think it was 2030. So basically saying that after 2030, they'll be able to their fossil fuel, their carbon emissions will start to decline, which is the first that I know of, first admission by the Chinese government that they need to do something about carbon about carbon emissions and about climate change. Did you see that? Did you read about that?
I did. It's not quite. It's the first agreement they've made with another country.
Okay.
But they instituted like a low carbon tax either last year or in 2012. Okay. And like basically one of the three big planks of the new leadership in China is environmental improvement, which isn't quite a global warming commitment, but a lot of it entails like reducing use of coal or trying to at least slow the growth in the use of coal. Because in addition to putting carbon into the atmosphere, coal's also just like very dirty and bad for people's health when you burn it, and people are like literally dying in China from this. It's huge. It's like a good first tentative agreement, like to really effectively try to like limit as best we can the effects of climate change. They're going to have to pursue more aggressive targets than what they've agreed to, but it's still this huge milestone because first and foremost, China, but also India and other developing countries like Brazil it's been this sort of open question whether they would enter into agreements to limit their burning of carbon. And that sort of also domestically in the United States, one of the sort of big reasons that people who are opposed, you know, as people who are sort of captive to the fossil fuel industry have raised for not wanting to really commit to making this transition and limiting our burning of carbon is, well, this is a global problem. Well, first, this isn't a problem. And then all of a sudden, their argument becomes, well, this is a global problem. And
even if they do something about it, China and India and Brazil won't do anything about it.
Yeah, that acting unilaterally is useless, right. Which was always a pretty shitty argument because the United States is the world leader, the biggest culprit when it comes to burning carbon. And therefore, it sort of was always incumbent upon us to take the lead, even if it was unilateral or even if it was only within a developed world framework to make that first step. But we didn't really do it. And so it took I think if we had done it earlier, there's a very good chance that we would have gotten China and India and these other countries to commit to limits earlier. But nonetheless, China has now sort of come into the fold. That argument domestically has been nullified. And these interests who are captive to fossil fuel interests have sort of one less bullshit excuse not to commit to the energy transition.
Right. So here's the question. Is the Chinese system, the Chinese government system, more adaptable to change, to quick change, which is obviously what's needed to combat carbon emissions and combat global climate change, are they better adapt to make those changes than the American democratic system because of the financial or the political influence that the fossil fuel lobby has, both coal and oil, has on the U.S. government?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd say yes and no. Certainly, yeah, in the United States, it's sort of a state under the like indirect control of industry and enterprise, and in China, you have industry and enterprise sort of much more under the control of the state. So yeah, China can do big things and do them quickly because they have a very strong state, and they don't have civil society or business interests or anything like that can really stand up to the state in an organized way.
Right.
And there's also just the fact that like that U.S. power markets are just like a regulatory nightmare. It's just extremely difficult. Right. To have a national program of anything in terms of energy because of the way that like utilities are regulated. On the flip side, we're also in another sense, like America is just a much more affluent society than China. So we sort of have that excess capacity in our system that we could dedicate to an energy transition in a way where doing so in China is you know, the question in China is like, okay, do we build like reasonable housing and get like cars for hundreds of millions of people? Whereas in the United States, you're not looking at the same kinds of trade-offs. You're looking at the trade-off of building less yachts or something.
Yeah. So let me jump in there. Okay. That was somewhat of a leading question because I tend to fall on the side that the Chinese government is probably more apt to make these changes quicker. And I don't, and I would push back a little bit on the fact that the U.S. society, because it's more affluent, has a larger space to make that change. Because I think this kind of leads into that article that we'll discuss in a minute that you sent me, that the cost of fossil fuels versus the cost of more green energy, the difference, which has been until recently great. So fossil fuels being a lot cheaper, to produce and to buy, green energy costs are coming down while fossil fuel costs are rising. So the economic interest, the economic incentive to use fossil fuels is disappearing. Do you agree with that? I mean, that you sent that article. Do you want to give us a little background about what we're talking about with that piece?
Sure. Well, I think in the long term, you're correct. Fossil fuel prices are only going to rise, and wind and solar is only going to fall. Although in the short and medium term, oil prices have been tanking recently.
Because of the fracking and the availability of the tar sands that the Keystone Pipeline would be able to access.
Yeah. And because the U.S. isn't legally, and also it doesn't have the infrastructure to export a lot of this stuff. So you get a glut in the States. I mean, long-term, sure, the long-term trends are that wind and solar are becoming, at certain points, like the cheapest, most effective wind and solar at this point can economically, even without a carbon tax, even with this like sort of massive implicit subsidy to fossil fuels, is naturally replacing fossil fuel. But there's energy is more complicated than just like the price of oil, the price of gas, the price of wind, the price of solar. Right. So there are going to be places where right away it's going to make sense to install wind, install solar, and it's going to be economical from the get-go. and there are other places where like those lines haven't crossed in terms of what's going to be more affordable. And there's always like stickiness. There's always sort of barriers to building new infrastructure. So I think that it's not just, I mean, especially without a carbon tax, it's not just about simply letting the price mechanism do its work. I think that you really need like sort of like a societal commitment to making a transition, because it's a massive transition to like really fundamentally change like the most important infrastructure in the economy.
That's why I'm saying that the Chinese government, because the Chinese is so the Chinese society is so centralized around the Communist Party, and the Chinese society, Chinese government, Chinese policy is all centralized, that it's going to be a lot easier for them to start saying, hey, let's be green or whatever their message is. And I honestly think that they'll make those changes a lot easier than the American system.
I understand what you're saying, and the reason that I say yes and no is just that I think that it's very hard to tell exactly how thinly stretched Chinese society is right now. Their growth is slowing down. There's a lot of social discontent now that had sort of been they sort of had what the United States had with the frontier for most of its history, which it was sort of this outlet for social discontent of just growth, growth, growth. And now that you're seeing that disappear, you know, is the state's hold on power going to get weaker? Do they really have this sort of just excess capacity in the system to really push in a radical way this new energy infrastructure? I think it's really an open question. Hopefully they can. I mean, there's a lot of fear that China, because they've been more aggressive than us in terms of like they've had the state has like aggressively subsidized solar manufacturing. They've invested heavily in energy storage technologies. So there is a legitimate fear that China is going to leapfrog us on renewable energy. And really, that would be a huge boon for them. I just think it's an open question at this point about whether they can pull it off over the next 20, 30 years.
Yeah. So there's additional factor to this that I want to bring into the conversation a little bit. And we haven't mentioned it in terms of renewable energy of any sort. But that's – have you ever heard of biomass or yeah. So this is the concept, the product of using biomass. So that's that can be plant material of any sort. That can be agricultural excess. That can be mainly those two. Stuff from deforestation, which is dangerous, which is part of the bad side. But it's basically using that as a fuel. So it can really easily replace coal, especially as an energy source. But it can actually replace petroleum products all the way down the line, could be the kind of future basis for our economy. So the idea right now is that our economy, or the capitalist global economy, is so inherently based on fossil fuels that any kind of movement away from that, any I think we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, any movement away from the fossil fuel economy is inherently not anti-capitalist, because if you take away fossil fuels, because fossil fuels are so integral to capitalism.
I would try telling that to the capitalists over at Sun Edison, and I'd try telling that to Elon Musk over at What's the name of his Solar City?
That's my exact argument, is that the opportunity to move to a more bio-based economy is a potential kind of kickback. So who was that woman who was on Colbert a couple of weeks ago? I think we mentioned her, who basically said that capitalism and environmentalism aren't exclusive. What's that?
Naomi Klein.
Naomi Klein. So this is the pushback to her, saying that there are these opportunities for, and I think this is what you were saying then as well, was that there are these opportunities to for a kind of new economy to emerge in the next, over the next couple decades.
Yeah, I mean, I think that her, I don't think that she would contest the fact that there are ways for capitalistic endeavors to lead an energy transition. I think that's exactly what's happening. I imagine, I haven't read her book, but I imagine that her point's a little broader than that, and just saying that sort of the structure of capitalism and capitalistic endeavors is such that inherently they exploit, like they sort of exploit and create negative externalities for the environment, and that like that they don't stop until they've depleted a resource as quickly as possible. And so that's just sort of a broader point than what she was saying. But yeah, I think it's, of course, it's like the biggest business opportunity of our generation is, right. I mean, just as oil was the biggest business opportunity of much of the 20th century, of our generation, it's going to be, okay, how do you provide like the single biggest input of the economy in a new way? So totally, people are going to become billionaires. I mean,
they already have been.
Yeah, I mean, individuals might make hundreds of billions of dollars off of technologies that create carbon-free energy. Totally.
Yeah. All right. Did you wanna go through that the rest of that article that you sent to us?
Oh yeah. So there's this guy Jeremy Grantham. I believe he's English-born. He's Boston-based. He is basically one of the best asset managers in the world. And his whole theory of investment, this is by way of background, is just that commodity prices rise and fall, but in the long term, they all sort of regress to a historical average. And so he has been phenomenally successful at managing money, and his approach is to look at the global economy in a very zoomed out way and look at macro trends. And so I sent around to a bunch of people, including Rowan, one of his recent investment newsletters that Barron's reprinted, that was about sort of the global energy conundrum. And it was basically about the fact that fossil fuels running out, that the entire industrial revolution, this sort of amazing fact of the last 200 years, which is that our standards of living, our material wealth, have all risen in the space of two centuries more than they'd risen for all of human history, was based on the fact that we figured out that we had this huge gift sitting under our feet, which was energy that was very easy to obtain and burn, that did work, that did much more work than we could do on our own. And now we're sort of running out of this precious gift. And that like our massive run of growth is now totally threatened by this, because like you can't just burn oil to do work for you. You can't do as much work. You can't do as much economic activity. So you're sort of looking at that. He's saying that if we can sort of get our act together as societies and make this transition to renewable energy in a reasonably quick and orderly fashion, then we can probably muddle through the next two or three decades before energy hopefully becomes cheap and plentiful again. But that, you know, if we don't, and especially in the United States, which is the biggest consumer of energy, there are a lot of entrenched interests that can sort of at the expense of society eke out little bits of profit for themselves at the end of this historic run, that we're in big trouble. He sort of threw cold water on the idea that fracking is really going to save the economy in the United States in the long run.
Called it a red herring. herring, I believe.
Yeah, he called it a big red herring. And he sort of acknowledged that actually the only real growth in the U.S. economy since the recession can basically be accounted for by fracking. Like, that's how big it's been in the short term, and it has been. But he does not think that's going to last. So, yeah, it was just like he's a very brilliant person who understands, like, the fundamentals of the global economy, and it was his take on the energy picture, which is a little bit bleak.
And did you want to quickly analyze that?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the upshot of what he's saying, the takeaway is just that, like, this country needs to get very, very serious about making its energy transition. And it, you know, needed to happen yesterday.
Yeah. And I think that is the also the argument of a lot of environmentalists and a lot of people who accept climate change as a reality and don't use the cop out. Well, I'm not a scientist, but and likewise the argument that China and India aren't going to be doing this. Well, they at least China seems to be already moving forward, and Brazil at least has leads the way in some green energy, especially biomass, which I know I'm harping on a little bit because I'm just learning a lot about it. But yeah, any final thoughts for the day?
No. What about you?
Not really. Next week, I think we'll hopefully have Louis back, and I think we might have another Brit on the show. We might be talking about a reader or a listener sent us an article about the British pubs no longer having to be owned by, or no, excuse me, having to buy their alcohol from one brewery. What's that?
Freedom.
Exactly. So, it looks like there'll be a little bit more of an open alcohol market in the UK. We might talk about that and, maybe some movie reviews as well. The other British guy is, Tom, who's been on the podcast before. May hopefully will come on. All right. I will, I'll talk to you next week, Ben.
Sweet.
Thanks for listening this week. Don't forget to follow Ben at Trek Reports, follow myself at RLM Kane, and follow the Volterra at the Volterra on Twitter, and subscribe to our iTunes podcast, the Volterra Podcast. See you next week.
When it's not always raining, there'll be days like this. When there's no one complaining, there'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this.